Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. As this afternoon, September 14, 2020, we have an interesting topic at hand. Now we're going to cover rights and wrongs, the Golden State Killer and genetic investigations. My name is Nick Marr. I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. And as always, please note that expressions of opinion on today's call are those of the experts. And we're fortunate to have with us this afternoon Arthur Reiser. He's the resident senior fellow and director of criminal justice and civil liberties at R Street Institute, and Nila Bala, the resident senior fellow and associate director of criminal justice and civil liberties at the R Street Institute. So after we're going to have a bit of a moderated conversation today, and after Arthur goes first and gives some background, we'll have some questions, some back and forth, and then at about 3:15, we'll open it up to audience questions. So be thinking of those and have them in mind for when we get to that portion of the call. Okay, and to begin, Arthur, I'll ask you the first question. Can you just give us some background? Who is the Golden State Killer? What's genetic investigation? How does it work? Just take it away. Yeah. The floor is yours.
Yeah. So let me start off by just explaining like who we're talking about. But I think that's important. Ultimately, the Constitution of the United States and the way that police conduct themselves should be the same across the board. But in reality, we know that's not really true, right? When we have really heinous crimes as a society, we've always been a little more willing to bend on what we consider appropriate as it comes to investigations. We have our lines in the sand. We have, the poisonous tree doctrine and such. But, the heinousness of this particular set of crimes, I think really did have an impact on how this kind of played out across this country. If this would have been a simple car theft where they had DNA for some bizarre reason, I don't think we would see the same earnestness by many on, like my side of the aisle and other sides of the aisle to kind of accept this. But so it's important to kind of give some background on who we're talking about. The Golden State Killer is Joseph DeAngelo. He committed about 120 burglaries, 50 rapes, and 13 murders between 1973 and 1986. And he really did get away with all of it. He was employed by a police officer in the 70s. So he had a certain amount of savviness when it came to investigations. And then later on, as a mechanic in six counties where he committed his crimes. And he used his knowledge of being a police officer and his know-how of his community in order to get away with it. After numerous unsuccessful investigations over like 40 years, officers turned to DNA evidence in late 2017 after creating an electronic DNA profile from genetic material they found in one of the rape kits. So officers uploaded their data into GEDmatch, an open source genetic database created from profiles of customers from DNA sites like 23andMe and such. So, one of the takeaways you can walk away from this is know that when you put your DNA into those databases, you're giving something up. Think about that. A partial match to a distant relative was found on that site and allowed officers to create a family tree of over 1,000 people. And then they, spent several months eliminating suspects until they, DeAngelo discarded personal items. They collected his DNA and they matched that to the kit sample, and he was then arrested. So, think about, what I started: 120 burglaries, 50 first degree rapes, 13 murders. You can see that the setup really, gives us the lens of how we're going to talk about the rest of this this case and this legal issue. Nila, who I work with, is just really, I would say, one of the foremost experts on looking at that balance between technology, privacy, and safety. And that's really the three things we're trying to balance here, right? We're trying to balance our individual privacy over, things that belong to us, our DNA. We're trying to balance public safety. This is an individual who was a murderer and a rapist and a terrible human being. That's just what we know about, by the way. Could be worse. He did plead to most of his cases, but we don't even know if all of there's evidence that that isn't even all the cases. And of course, we're balancing this idea of how technology is going to be used. So that's kind of a setup for what we're going to be talking about.
So I'll send the second question over to Nila. Could you explain a bit about how genetic genealogy works to solve crimes and to solve these crimes that we're talking about today?
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having me. So if there is DNA that's collected at the site of a crime, typically what law enforcement will immediately do is run it through state and national databases. And if you've ever heard of CODIS, that's what we're talking about here. So when that happens, sometimes a match doesn't come back, right? I mean, CODIS is a pretty robust system. It has 18 million profiles, but only profiles of people who've generally been arrested or convicted. And so it's very possible that an individual doesn't come up with a match in CODIS. And so that often ends up as what we call a cold case. Their DNA is just sitting somewhere. And that's what happened with the Golden State Killer. Even though those cases happened primarily in the 70s and 80s, they couldn't find a match to the DNA that was collected at those crime scenes. And so they just had to wait. What genetic genealogy does is it harnesses these open source public databases to provide law enforcement far more DNA in terms of the information they can look at to compare it to the DNA they collected at a crime scene. So again, typically how this works is on the back end, a person sends their saliva to a site like 23andMe or Ancestry.com, which, just to be clear, are not open source databases, but they get back a raw DNA file, which they can then upload to these open source databases that Arthur mentioned, like GEDmatch or FamilyTree DNA. These sites were originally created for people to find long-lost relatives. So you could upload your DNA and hopefully you'd get a match back and you'd find, you know, an uncle or a cousin that you didn't know you had. But another way that law enforcement realized they could use this is if they uploaded that raw DNA from the crime scene that they couldn't find a match through traditional channels like CODIS, into the same open source database and basically created a profile without, you know, being the actual person who this DNA belongs to, they might find a match. And, you know, with the Golden State Killer case, it was, again, a very partial match, a great-great-grandparent or something like that. And then it's traditional genealogy at work. So you have to build out a family tree and, you know, use traditional detective techniques to try to figure out who it could have been in terms of the age and location. And then mistakes can be made, I should mention, because you are guessing to some extent who it could be. And so even in the Golden State Killer, initially, the wrong individual was identified. The last step to kind of sealing the deal is to try to get some discarded DNA from the individual that you think is actually responsible and see if it matches the DNA that you originally collected from the crime scene. And that's kind of in a nutshell how forensic genetic genealogy works.
So law enforcement, you know, police have many tools that they can use. Why is this one important? I'll ask either one of you, Arthur or Nila.
Yeah, so I mean, real briefly, the reason it's so important is because, I mean, you think about how this case was solved. I mean, it was a cold case and it was frozen in a locker buried on the bottom of a freezer. This was not coming out. We were not going to solve this case. So this allows you to almost go back in time and create a new you know, set of facts associated to this case. It's actually just, it's amazing. It's like when we first started doing fingerprinting index and, you know, officers have been collecting certain amounts of fingerprints for years back in the 20s, and they were able to match them up using the index, and they were able to solve a series of cases. So this has incredible potential to solve some cases, because you don't need to have a direct match to the individual. So you don't need, you know, D'Angelo didn't, you know, put his DNA up on the website. One of his relatives did. So like my sister has done 23andMe. They would be potentially be able to match my DNA through that sibling relationship. And if they were looking for me for a crime because they had my DNA, they would be able to match that. So it is an incredible tool simply because it allows you to go back and relook at cases that were dead. And that right there is just in itself incredible. Scary, but incredible.
Yeah, I'll just add that, GEDmatch and FamilyTree DNA have DNA profiles from individuals that, again, this may be obvious, but are different from the profiles in CODIS, right? Quite a few scholars have commented that CODIS is racially skewed towards having more Black and Brown individuals in its database because we know they are more likely to be arrested and accused of crime and convicted. And so in contrast, GEDmatch actually, I would say, skews towards white Americans. One study a couple years ago found that 60% of white Americans can be identified through GEDmatch, meaning, some relative, again, could be a distant relative, has already uploaded their information to these open source databases. And through, genealogy techniques, you can actually identify now almost 2/3 of white Americans. And so it just opens up a much larger pool of individuals, which is kind of what Arthur was alluding to as well.
Yeah, so this obviously changes a lot. What are the kinds of concerns that have arisen with genetic genealogy websites being used in this way?
Yeah, I'm happy to take a first stab at that. I think there are two major concerns that I can pinpoint. And I just want to echo Arthur that in a case like the Golden State Killer, when you're weighing privacy and public safety, it feels very reasonable to say public safety, given the nature of the crimes, the number of the crimes that D'Angelo committed, definitely weighs in favor of using this technique. The problem is right now we don't really have any guidelines that make clear to law enforcement or the government when these techniques should be used. And privacy is incredibly important too. Of course, privacy is a necessary human value. It allows us to have a functioning civic society. It allows us to have a private space where we can develop our own identities and flourish. It is the basis of the Fourth Amendment, right? So certainly important enough for our founders to enshrine in our Constitution. But two major concerns of using these open source databases in this way. The first is that when you upload your information, there's a consent that you expect it perhaps to be used in a certain way. And one could argue that the use of law enforcement in this technology is not necessarily what people expected when they uploaded their profiles. I will say that since the Golden State Killer case, there have been quite a few changes to both of the websites I mentioned, which are, I would say, kind of the top two open source databases. GEDmatch has switched over from, I would say, like an opt-out policy to an opt-in policy, meaning individuals now have to say they are willing to have law enforcement look at their profile. That being said, if you have uploaded your information and you haven't logged in a while, then it might just be there, right, as an opt-out feature. A family tree has gone the other direction where the default is law enforcement can look at your profile unless you say you don't want them to. So I think both of these sites have recognized that users should be involved in consenting to a use that they expect. But I will say the second concern I have is that you're also consenting on behalf of a lot of other people when you upload your information, right? So even if you expect that your information can be used by law enforcement officers in this way, you are consenting on behalf of third cousins, right? That have never been met that have never even uploaded their information to the site because DNA is linked to families. So you could be consenting for a lot of other people that don't expect that. So those are two of the concerns I would identify.
Yeah, two more concerns that I think are important is one, this is an incredibly useful tool, but if it's abused, we could see a rollback by the courts. And what I mean by that is if you know, if the court finds that this is, there's an aura of infallibility around this type of testing, they could, like they did in U.S. Versus Schaefer in 1988, dealing with polygraphs. So I'm not comparing polygraphs to this, all right? There's a total difference in the scientific method testing when it comes to these two. But you saw the court just kind of throw out this entire area that we can use. So if we get them, if we get it wrong enough times, you can see the court doing that. So that leads me to my second point: is this is really high tech type of stuff. I mean, when the Golden State Killer case, the individual who did the testing, who had a PhD in biology, had experience working in this type of area, and there's a high degree of care, but many departments don't have that. You have individuals who don't have enough, you know, a ton of experience doing these types of tests, and you know, human error can really have a very damning effect. But think about it: when you have human error in, you know, an identity type of case, you know, this person saw you, but you weren't really there. You know, you can argue in court misidentification. You know, it really becomes down to the jury and, you know, circumstantial evidence, whether you were there at the time, whether they could have saw you, how dark it was, yada, yada, yada. All the stuff we learn in trial lab. But when it comes to DNA, man, if your DNA matches, the jury is going to believe you. You are going to go to prison. And so it is incredibly important that we have the right individuals doing these tests. And in many counties across this country, they just can't afford to have the cream of the crop testing. So they look to other types of places. You know, there was a documentary done that many of this testing is done in like these roving labs that are, you know, basically on wheels. And you can have misidentifications. In early 2000, the Houston Police Department was routinely misinterpreting DNA evidence, leading to false convictions for rape and murder. Think about that. That is just crazy to me. And I think many people should be really weary about that. You know, the most famous case is a 16-year-old Josiah Sutton. He was falsely imprisoned for 4 years based on faulty DNA evidence. And that's just human error. What about all the cases that we know where we have, you know, officials, you know, falsifying records because they want a conviction? I mean, the Fred Zane case, if anybody doesn't know what that is, look it up. Fred Zane, Z-A-I-N. I mean, this is a guy who operated in West Virginia for years and years and years. And you can trace hundreds and hundreds of false convictions back to him. He was literally making up data as it related to criminal convictions. There's as many as 180 wrongful convictions associated to this guy and triple that amount of cases that he was involved in. And oh, and just as a cherry on top, after he left West Virginia, after he was discredited, he went to Texas and was a forensic investigator there afterwards, which is just bizarre that we didn't pick that up. But you think about, you add all these things together, and then just how believability. I mean, you know, in the prosecutorial world, we call it the CSI effect, because juries, when they hear the word DNA, are trained to think, oh, this is absolute. There is no way that this is wrong. And so it is just a nail in the coffin. And when we get it wrong, we can end up falsely convicting people. So that's another area that we should be very wary about.
So before we go and talk about the law, the current law, what the law could be, some solutions, maybe a little bit of more background on this technical stuff. First, who actually does this genetic work? You mentioned that there's a lot of room for human error in this one. Guy who is doing it is very well trained. So Arthur, if you could talk a little bit about who actually does this work, and then Nila, if you could explain a little bit about how this is different from regular genetic testing that we've had around for a while. So Arthur, I'll give it to you first.
Yeah, that's actually one of the issues, is that we don't know who exactly is doing the DNA testing within these private companies. They don't have to release all that. So, I mean, here's a perfect example. My sister and I both did one of those 23andMe, and we ended up with a pretty different genetic background, even though we have the same parents, and we're pretty sure we have the same parents. And I think that was, you know, kind of an eye-awakening about how accurate these are. So when it comes to, you know, the private actors, we don't know a lot. We don't actually know. You know, I can tell you that I think the vast majority is automated. It happens through computers, and their testing is something that you basically plug in the sample and it spits out a reading and it uploads it to its database. As it relates to the government side of things, I mean, there are a lot of counties actually have contracts with different organizations that will do this type of testing for them. The FBI obviously has a very robust testing system, and every state patrol that I know of has a testing center that they can test things in serious crimes for serious crimes. So, you know, this is really something done by the police. However, you know, many times these things are triggered by defense attorneys who think that their case, their client is innocent, and so they want to start poking around in the DNA files. And obviously, prosecutors have that duty as well to ensure if they have a probable cause or they have, you know, reason to believe that an individual may be innocent, they have the moral and the legal duty to start poking around. But that's, you know, in a nutshell, who's doing these testing and how it's getting done.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I'll just say that there are a couple of places we can think of that human error could be introduced, and Arthur's mentioned a few of them. The first is the initial DNA collection that ends up, you know, creating this cold case. There's also a subsequent DNA collection once you've identified a suspect, and then you wait for them to discard some DNA publicly, like, you know, a cup that they drank from, something like that. And then, of course, there's actually inputting the DNA you find, the processing of it. So there's a couple of different points where human error can be introduced. And those aren't necessarily unique to forensic genetic genealogy. Those are also points of error in sort of your more traditional crime-solving techniques with DNA. The difference with using genetic genealogy, I'll say there's a few things. One is, CODIS was never created to identify full genetic genomes, right? It was really created as a crime-solving database, and it's a government database for that purpose. And so it uses just identifying a part of the DNA that's what's called non-coding, meaning you can't tell from what's in CODIS, you know, if a person has a certain hair color or if they have a certain eye color or a certain health attribute. It's really just identify the person versus 23andMe and sites like that do a far more genetic testing and give you far more information. So the raw DNA files that people are uploading into sites like GEDmatch use a technique called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNP. And the problem with this is that you potentially revealed quite a bit more genetic information. And that's actually one of the issues with this technology, not just that you're identifying people, and of course there can be human error, but that the information that you're providing is quite vast. And right now we're kind of just relying on the good graces and civic mindedness of law enforcement to necessarily delete a profile that they create on behalf of somebody in one of these databases, and, you know, ensure that this person's DNA isn't just on this site for perpetuity, or a third party might even be able to acquire it for some not so benign means. I mean, just in July of this year, there were two breaches to GEDmatch by hackers. And so DNA isn't like your credit card number if it gets hacked. You know, you can't just change your DNA if something goes wrong. And so we just need to be really careful about how we go about doing these processes and in which cases we use this technology.
So let's talk a little bit about, based on these concerns that we've raised, but also, you know, it's potentially, or it is a really powerful tool. So I guess we can start. Are there any laws in place that already govern this process? And I'll open that up to either one of you.
Laws, I would say Nilla is more up to date on this. I would say not really. There are, you know, most state patrol and the Department of Justice has been having internal guidelines about how this information is supposed to be used. And, you know, I was actually heartened when I read it getting ready for this, that The focus is on privacy and on liberty. And I thought that was good. Usually, you know, I was a prosecutor at DOJ. You know, most of the stuff that DOJ does is focused on ensuring that there's success in the courtroom for prosecution. So it was good. It was heartening for me to see that, you know, genetic privacy was something at the top of their list of concerns. I don't know if there's, I do remember last year some states, legislators looking at passing laws on this. But really the body that's been kind of maintaining this is the Supreme Court, and they are really behind the times. I mean, there's only really one major case, Maryland versus King, that really kind of has any type of genetic privacy, you know, rulings. And they basically said that an officer can take a DNA swab from the mouth on arrest. And it's interesting that that was, you know, a split court. I mean, it was 5-4 with Kennedy siding with the dissenter, Scalia siding with the dissenters. So it was kind of a split across ideological lines on what they were going to allow.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the issues right now is we don't have a lot of guidance either from state legislatures or from courts about exactly how this technology should be used. This previous legislative session, so I'm talking about, you know, for most states, the spring session of 2020, there were four states that did introduce bills to try to either ban this technology or regulate it in some way or to allow it, but in very specific circumstances or with a valid legal process. The four states were Utah, Maryland, New York, and Washington State, but none of those bills actually went all the way through. Probably at least partly due to COVID-19 and a lot of legislative sessions, you know, shutting down early and really focusing their concerns on pandemic relief. There's also been an interim policy that the DOJ released, and this was pretty much exactly a year ago now, September 2019. And it kind of cautioned law enforcement departments to really use this technology as a last resort when they had really extinguished all other crime-solving techniques. And so, yeah, there really is a void right now in terms of guidance as to, again, what offenses these techniques should be used for, whether there should be some kind of warrant process or a legal process through which a third party is reviewing instances in which law enforcement wants to use this technology, and also guidance for these open source databases and companies to help tell them and guide them in terms of how users should be informed and should have informed consent that the information they upload could be used in this way.
Interesting. Arthur, what has the Supreme Court said on this topic or similar topics, if anything? And what, and are there any cases that we should be looking out for as regards to this topic?
Yeah, I think I jumped the gun on that question a little bit. There isn't a lot. The most parallel things that we can look at are things specifically related to DNA collection, and that was Maryland versus King 2013. And that's the most relevant case we have. And what that case said was that an officer can collect DNA from an individual who's been arrested and compare it against databases unrelated to unsolved crimes, cold cases and rape kits and such. I will say, though, that one thing that is true that many people get confused about is, you know, even in the case of D'Angelo, the Golden State Killer, the police were using this to build a case in order to get a warrant in order to go arrest Mr. D'Angelo. And actually, part of that warrant said they were allowed to collect his DNA. So the investigation was built obviously on these tools, but then they went back to old fashioned, getting a warrant from an Article III judge, you know, saying they had probable cause to believe that he was the individual they were looking for. Here's the evidence that we have. And there wasn't, you know, a dispassionate judge that looked at that evidence and made that decision. So that still is a very important caveat. When I first read about some of these, it made it seem like all you needed to do was do this match, and then magically the government would come and grab your DNA. They actually still go through the normal process when they have enough probable cause to believe that you're the person they're looking for.
I'll just add, and this isn't a Supreme Court case that appears on face perfectly on point, but does kind of tell us something about the direction that courts might go in the future to sort of contemplate this technology, and that's Carpenter, which was a cell phone case. So again, it's not about DNA, but what was interesting about the Carpenter case is that it took a way that we had thought about the Fourth Amendment for a long time and sort of shifted it, which was that the idea was that if you did something in public, on the public thoroughfares, on the road, you didn't really have an expectation of privacy to that information. If the state happened to observe you doing something publicly, then you had given up your right to privacy. And what Carpenter kind of explored was just the amalgamation of information that people now, I should say the government now, has access to is really different because of technology. And so, yes, if I saw you in one place at one time, that's one piece of information that maybe you don't have an expectation of privacy to. But, you know, with cell phone pinging off of towers and looking at months of that information, now we're looking at a very different picture where I can learn quite a bit about you and your movements and your patterns and your habits. And that's why the court said, well, this actually is an infringement of the Fourth Amendment. And in some ways, this technology might be similar where, yes, you are uploading your DNA to this open source database. And in a way, you've exposed yourself in your DNA and you've knowingly done that. But the amount and scope of information you're providing, and also the way that it's being used in a way that you didn't initially contemplate, is different than maybe what you initially thought. And so DNA might be in that category of new technologies that our previous Fourth Amendment jurisprudence just doesn't do a really great job of capturing people's expectations of privacy around. And this may be an area where courts, you know, revisit and say, how can we fashion the doctrine to really respond to and take into account how people really think about their privacy.
It's very interesting. Kind of in keeping with this, and also drawing on our discussion a few minutes ago about the different concerns and also potential solutions. And Nilla, you might want to take a first crack at this. What are the kinds of concerns that arise, and also problems with or potential for regulation of these private companies that are doing the testing? And Arthur mentioned, you know, that there are different people at these places. We don't know much about how they're doing it. And what are the kinds of concerns there, if any? And then what are kinds of some kinds of solutions? And then how do you think, you know, courts or different legislators might think about these issues?
Yeah, that's a great question. Right now, genetic genealogy in sort of the forensic realm has been described as the wild, wild west, because there aren't a lot of rules and a lot of guidance for these companies. And so it's often up to the founders of these companies to kind of make it up as they go along. And I'll give you a really concrete example. So when GEDmatch first realized that their technology could be used in this way, Curtis Rogers, who was the owner and founder at that time, made clear that he wanted the technology to only be used to solve the most violent of crimes, so specifically like murders and rapes. And that's kind of where he drew the line. What happened was he was contacted by law enforcement in Utah after an assault had taken place at a Mormon meeting house. And they really wanted to use the GEDmatch technology for this assault. And previously, again, GEDmatch had been very clear that was not an offense that they wanted to have that technology used for. They only wanted it for the most grave and heinous of crimes. But he relented, Curtis Rogers relented, and allowed the technology to be used. And there was definitely an outcry. And I think the reason was because the users at that time had been, you know, sort of primed and told that their information could be used by law enforcement, but only in, again, these two categories of cases. And then suddenly things were changed on them. That line shifted, and that line shifted because of one gentleman's decision to the founder in this case to allow that to shift. And so that's kind of tricky when there's so much power that these private entities hold to keep shifting guidelines. And actually, one of the reasons I think GEDmatch switched over to an opt-in policy was because of the backlash from you know, this incident that I'm describing, where users really wanted to know that you know, their information would be used by law enforcement and actively say yes to participating in that process. So I think where the government could really step in and provide some guidance is to, you know, make clear that users need to have informed consent and be educated about when and how their information is going to be used. They may, in fact, make it very clear that this technique should be confined only to certain violent crimes, that there needs to be some sort of Fourth Amendment-esque process in place, like obtaining a warrant. Because right now, if you look at every step of the process, you don't necessarily, you don't have to get a warrant because when they identified, for example, D'Angelo as a potential suspect in the Golden State Killer case, they just the law enforcement officers just waited for him to discard some DNA publicly, which you are, you know, allowed to pick up as law enforcement, you know, it's trash essentially. And so there isn't a process to govern the fact that law enforcement had created a profile and put it on this open source database, and nothing that regulated whether they should delete it at some point, how to protect that person's information. And so those are some of the things we could think about shaping. And I think some of the things that states have contemplated, like I mentioned, the four states that have introduced bills, kind of contemplate creating some guidelines and some guardrails for this technology.
Arthur, do you have anything to add on this point?
No, I think Noah hit a home run on that one. I think that's exactly how we should be thinking about it. And I think that I do, you know, as Noah talked about that DOJ guidance memo, that was something they sent to their prosecutors. And it specifically, you know, talked about the dangers that could come, meaning losing the ability to use these tools if they were abused. They also specifically said that if there's not some type of procedural safeguards, they didn't want federal prosecutors using these DNA matching methods, which, again, I took as a, you know, they didn't have to do this. They did it because they thought it was the right thing to do as a government body. So that was, you know, an example of the government, you know, actually limiting themselves, which is rare in these day and age.
Are there any courts, maybe lower courts, looking at this now, or should we expect it soon in the future, later in the future? What do you think?
I think it's going to come up. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's cases that are rolling using this stuff. So these are things that are gonna work their way up. And we're gonna, I would say within the next year or two, we're gonna see a direct case challenging the constitutionality of these cases. And the thing about the Golden State Killer case is that he pled guilty. And so, you know, in order not to get the death penalty. So, you know, we're not gonna see that case probably come up for any type of appeal because of waiving his rights. But I think that we'll see definitely other cases as time goes on.
Yeah, I'll just say that it has come up a few times, but not really been resolved and certainly just been in lower courts. One interesting case was in November. A Florida judge actually allowed all of GEDmatch to be searched, even those profiles who hadn't necessarily opted in to wanting law enforcement to be able to see their profiles. So there's definitely some interesting cases where, you know, the state has wanted to expand the use of this technology or use it in a way that currently GEDmatch doesn't allow. GEDmatch was recently, I should also mention, acquired by a company called Verigen. This was, I want to say, in December of last year. And Verigen has been in the business of working directly with law enforcement even before acquiring GEDmatch. And so if anything, I would guess and anticipate that we'll see even more collaboration between some of these private companies and the law enforcement groups, because now GEDmatch is owned by a company that has very specifically said publicly that they believe this technology can and should be used in this way.
Interesting. Okay. Now for the audience, we'll open it up for audience questions here in a second. In order to do that, we'll all hear a prompt in a moment indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please press star and then pound on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star and then pound on your telephone keypad to request the floor. We'll answer questions, take the questions in the order in which they're received. To give our audience a minute to line up here with any questions they might have, I'll ask another question, and you you know, it's a little bit outside the scope, so you don't have to take it. But I see some similarities between this, what we're talking about with law enforcement company cooperation, and the kind of issue that came up a few years ago with Apple and a terrorist investigation, and how the DOJ has been handling that. So I don't know if either of you want to speak about kind of the similarities. Maybe this whole body of law might kind of develop in a similar way or a different way based on differences.
Yeah. So I've written a little bit about that situation with Apple, and you know, there really became a pissing match between the FBI and Apple over whether or not they were going to unlock phones or whatever. I think a couple of things are important in that case is that one, Apple actually sent engineers out to help in San Bernardino with unlocking that phone. They were trying to help. What Apple was not willing to do was create backdoors in their software in order to make it easy for the government to do. So yeah, there are similarities in the sense that there's this intersection between privacy, law enforcement, safety. But you know, Apple has been since then has been actively resisting the government's you know, pressure in order to create backdoors and such. So similarities, but pretty different in the sense of how the companies have responded.
Interesting.
Yeah, I would agree with Arthur on that. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to give another announcement to our audience. We don't have any questions in the queue right now, so wide open. If you press star and then pound on your telephone keypad, you could get right to the front here. Oh, and we have one now.
Oh, hi. I didn't hear anyone talking so much about the differences between testimonial and sort of non-testimonial evidence. I mean, you brought up the cell phone, which has a lot of sort of personal data, which is not like a fingerprint. It's sort of things you said or did, which does, that seems to be quite different. Whereas the DNA evidence seems much more like a fingerprint. Is this something that isn't your private information, the sense of your thoughts or your actions? It's just something that's unique to you as a person. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that. Thanks.
Yeah. So what this gentleman is talking about is if something is testimonial, meaning that it has to come from your brain, in essence. There's been a higher standard placed upon the government's ability to get that, to the point of there are even some First Amendment cases that say that you're not only breaching the Fourth Amendment, but you're breaching the First Amendment when you start to reach into people's minds and such. But DNA evidence has been clearly ruled not to be testimonial. It is the same as a fingerprint in the sense that it's something the government gathers from you. The interesting thing is that before some of these cases, that because it's something the government would grab from you, like blood from a car accident or whatever, they have been, you know, the courts have been usually more protective because it was actually taking something from your body. But that seems, after the Maryland versus King case, it seems that that's kind of fallen by the wayside, that they truly are looking at this. If you are arrested, they are allowed to take this from you. You know, when it comes to actually invading your body in some way, like taking blood or something, there is a higher threshold in those cases. But no, that's a great observation that this is not considered testimonial in the sense that you are giving something up that comes from your inner mind.
No, anything to add?
No, I think Arthur pretty much covered it. I will say one interesting thing that differentiates fingerprints from DNA is that with fingerprints, you know generally when you're touching something and you're leaving it behind. But with DNA, you know, you can discard DNA from your skin and from your hair without even knowing. So that's one argument scholars have made, that we should be even more protective of DNA and genetic material when compared to fingerprints and the way that people discard it. But I completely agree with the legal analysis that it wouldn't be considered testimonial. I don't think courts have come to that conclusion. And so, you know, Crawford and the Confrontation Clause and all of that probably wouldn't apply. That being said, I think there have been some attempts, like I mentioned, in lower courts to try to challenge the way that genetic genealogy has been done in particular cases, and try to make this argument akin to the Carpenter case that I mentioned earlier, that, you know, this is not something that was contemplated with the Fourth Amendment. And yes, on its face, there is no warrant requirement for any part of the genetic genealogy process, but maybe there should be because of the large amount of information, the scope of information, the unexpected nature in which this information is being used. So that argument has been tried, I believe, in a Virginia court last year. So we'll see. We'll see what happens as courts contemplate this and try to you know, take the former Fourth Amendment doctrine and make it relevant to this scenario.
Interesting. Okay, we'll go to our next caller now. We've got two questions in the queue. You have the floor.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for this discussion. It's very interesting. I guess I was interested in hearing some comments on Carpenter, the holding in Carpenter. It seems to be one of the holdings in Carpenter that says that when looking at Fourth Amendment rights and privacy rights, that the court was going to look at whether or not the fundamental balance between the individual and government would be altered by new technology. And they were going to say, we're going to judge new technologies by not altering that balance that existed at the time of the founding. I'm wondering if you think that might be some kind of guide to answering some of these genetic privacy questions. And secondly, as far as GEDmatch and consent goes, it seems to me that, you know, unless you uploaded your own personal genetic data to those databases, there is no consent by a third party or a family member. And how does that play into your thoughts on this Fourth Amendment analysis?
Well, I'll take a first stab at it. I think, great question. I think the first thing I'll say is, one of the big differences between this and Carpenter and such is Carpenter really revolved around the what the government had to do to get a warrant. You know, what they're doing in these cases, they're building a case in order to get a warrant. So, and I mean, it's clear there's so much precedent out there, whether you like it or not, the agents. I mean, I was a federal prosecutor. I would send agents out all the time to go pick up garbage. They hated it, but they did it because we needed it. You know, mainly looking for paraphernalia as related to drug distributions. So what happens here is they actually still go get a warrant. So that does short circuit that analysis a little bit. So you would have to go further back in time and the question would be, when is a warrant necessary? When would you have to get a warrant? And, you know, if we're thinking about this as fingerprinting, we run fingerprints through, you know, databases all the time. So it's a little messier than a straight, you know, analysis. It gets a little more complex. That's my comments on that, but it's a good question.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think the language and sort of the dicta that you're pointing to in Carpenter does signal that the court might be willing to think about the third party, you know, consent doctrine, essentially the fact that if you share something with a third party, you've lost your rights to privacy over it in a different way. You know, the court did say in Carpenter that the unique nature of cell phone location records means that just because the information is held by a third party does not overcome the user's claim to Fourth Amendment protection, because they do have a legitimate expectation of privacy in, you know, these weeks and weeks of physical movements. And so even when a user does upload their information to this third party, in this case, GEDmatch, does it overcome their claim to all Fourth Amendment protections when that information is used in a different way, in an unexpected way, and given, again, like just the scope of DNA itself? I mean, that's the question, right? So I think you're right to ask it. It's the same argument that I I mentioned that Virginia case that happened. It's the same argument that the defense attorneys tried to make in that Virginia case. This was Jesse, and I don't know how to say his last name, the defendant's last name. I think it's Bjerke, B-J-E-R-K-E, in case you want to look it up. It's a 2016 rape case where they used a public genealogy database to track him down as the suspect. And the judge rejected this Carpenter-esque argument, saying that a warrant should be needed, or some third-party process should be needed to review the fact that his DNA, you know, was obtained and used, and kind of went back to our normal Fourth Amendment doctrine that, hey, he abandoned his DNA, and so the police's use of it did not reveal any private or personal information other than his identity as a suspect in this case. And so far, as we've seen, courts have not been willing to kind of make the analogy and make the argument. And I think your point that you brought up that, hey, there are these fourth parties essentially who really haven't consented to this use of their DNA is a really good one. And to me, Arthur was the prosecutor and a former law enforcement officer. And I didn't mention this at the onset of the call, but my background is as a former public defender. So my inclination is to say, well, it really would be important to have some sort of magistrate or judge process throughout this sort of three-step process that I described in the beginning of how genetic genealogy works, and make sure that we're comfortable with the way law enforcement is doing it. And there's so many little things that, you know, just if we could have some oversight or some guidelines, it could really make a big difference. And I'll give you one really quick example. When you go on GEDmatch, you have a choice of four different options as to how you want your profile to be viewed, whether you want it for private use only, where it would function essentially as a one-way mirror. Like, you could look out and see if you get any matches, but nobody could see you. And right now, there isn't a rule that law enforcement has to check that box. The other three boxes are for research use, for public use, but opt out of law enforcement, and for public use, opt into law enforcement. And so if law enforcement chooses the fourth option, the public use opt in, then that means everyone else on GEDmatch can see that person's profile and also make connections to all their family members. And they haven't necessarily, consented to that, right? Because they're not even the ones who have uploaded their own information. So there's like small things like that where I think if we had guidelines, it could really make a big difference in helping to protect fourth parties that you mentioned in your question.
Okay, great. We've got one question left, and then we'll try to wrap it up here, coming up on 3:30. So we'll go to our final questioner.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the questioner before me and Neela's answer, because you knocked out 95% of my questions with the two. I'm curious, though, because Arthur said that he felt fingerprinting was very, very similar to this. And I would argue on the other side and say that it's completely different, because in the fingerprint situation, you've already got the permission and you've uploaded it into a database similar to CODIS. In this case, that's not what's happened. You have fourth parties that have come in and put it into a database, and then law enforcement are now matching against that database without consent. And I think Carpenter strongly suggested that, when Carpenter actually gave consent with his phone, that CSLI theoretically was authorized. However, because it was held by a third party and Carpenter didn't like it, that was covered under the Fourth Amendment, because there was so much data that could be available, so that there was a cause. In this case, there's an awful lot there, plus you don't have a consent. Can you both address that? It seems to me that the Golden State Killer could have actually easily gotten off, I guess, if he had not pled guilty just based on that.
Yeah, I would say that I'm sure everybody here who's a defense attorney and a prosecutor can attest that, we like to think that justice is blind and justice, reigns, in this vacuum. But in reality, I don't agree with that last statement. I think that the heinousness of this crime, I think, kind of set the tone for how this was going to be treated. That's just my personal opinion. The world will never know. What I was saying is that I think that the way that the courts so far have been analyzing this is through the fingerprinting regime. I personally believe that this is different. And that's why I think legislators need to quickly start to talk about what the differences is and how we need to view those differences. Because you're absolutely right. I mean, I think the fingerprinting is the closest thing that we can look to. However, you're right. There is this other person who inputted their data. I mean, the best analogy that I can think of would be the twin who has, of course, twins don't have identical fingerprints, so that doesn't even work. But you get my gist of how, you know, you could, your fingerprints will be left without you knowing it or something to that effect, which can't actually happen. So that was a bad example. But my point is that that this is the way the courts have been looking at this thus far. And I think if we don't do something, if the legislative body doesn't do anything, that's the way it's going to keep pushing, especially looking at the how the court we have right now is made up.
Yeah, I'll just say that I think, the person who asked this question really hit on the heart of the issue. And my personal feeling is that when we're shaping laws and policies, we shouldn't just look to the most heinous case or the most grave case, the Golden State Killer case in this instance, but we should look to other ways that this technology could be used and fashion something that really balances privacy and safety overall, right? Because I think after the Golden State Killer case was solved in this manner, you didn't see a large outcry from privacy advocates or scholars kind of articulating the concerns that, the individual who just asked the question articulated, because everyone was just, glad that this cold case had been solved. And it really was one of the worst serial killers and rapists that was out there a few decades ago. But the flip side is that we know, 80% of state dockets are misdemeanors. And right now, this technology is not being used in those cases because there is still a pretty significant cost and process involved. And the way that most local and state governments have used this technology is they don't have the ability in-house to do the genetic genealogy matching because it's not just the uploading of the raw DNA. Which, by the way, might be just partial, like you might just have a fragment of DNA. So they generally are, contracting with a company called Terabon, which does the work of actually putting the DNA, figuring out the matches, creating a family tree the old-fashioned way, and providing law enforcement with some ideas of who the suspect could be. And one of the most famous women who works with Terabon now and worked on the Golden State Killer case, I believe, is CeCe Moore. So if you're interested in learning more, feel free to Google Terabon and CeCe Moore, and you can read lots about it. But right now we don't, like you were saying, have any ways to regulate and make sure fourth parties are protected. So my position is not that we should get rid of this technology or not use it. I think it's incredibly powerful crime fighting technology and crime solving technology, but that we just need more guidelines and information. There needs to be more of an educational campaign so that, I at least have some awareness as, Joe Schmo on the street that this could happen. And I think right now most individuals don't realize that, their Aunt Betty could be uploading their information essentially to this open source database and it could result in this kind of thing happening. And so my sort of position is, don't throw it all out. I think it's powerful. I think if we use it in the right cases with the right guidance, we could kind of fashion a middle ground that's fair and reasonable.
Great. Thanks very much. And since we're almost up on 3:30, I'll offer a chance for any closing remarks that you, Arthur, or Nilla might want to offer before we close out this afternoon.
I have a hard break at 3:30. So I will let Nilla have the closing remarks, but I'm just honored to be able to speak and what an engaging topic and great question. So thank you for letting me speak today. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Arthur.
Yes, thank you so much to the Federal Society and to all the individuals who submitted questions. They really were very thoughtful, and I appreciate that. I'm just hopeful that whether the guidance comes from courts or it comes from state and local legislative bodies, that we start to get more guidance and more information about how this technology can be used. I think it's really exciting and really interesting technology. And in the last 2 years since the Golden State Killer case was solved, there have been close to, I think, 120 cases solved in this way. And every subsequent case has brought up some more interesting and new issues. And I think, like all uses of technology, it's something we should not sort of cloak with infallibility that, hey, it's DNA and hey, it's technology. And, you know, we should educate ourselves and try to understand it. And I think, and try to fashion guidelines, you know, that really think about the core of the Fourth Amendment and people's legitimate, reasonable expectations of privacy and help balance these two concerns, which will always be concerns in the justice system of privacy and public safety in a way that we as the American public feel comfortable and good about. I'll just leave it with that.
Great. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you, Nila, and Arthur, who had to leave us early, for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today discussing this issue. And to the audience, thank you for calling in. Thank you for your questions. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. And keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming telephone calls. So thank you all for joining us this afternoon. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.